Now, have you ever thought there might be something out there?
It's a lot of rain at the moment. Well, it's 30 years since Suffolk became the focus of world attention for UFO experts after mysterious sightings in Rendlesham Forest. And today, retired American servicemen have been speaking about the encounter. Malcolm Robertson has more.
Ladies and gentlemen!
There are those who continue to pour scorn over claims of UFOs and aliens in Suffolk, but there are also others who believe something extraordinary happened in 1980 and that strange goings-on are still taking place today in Rendlesham Forest. Malcolm Robertson, Anglia News, Suffolk.
Well, who knows him? Right.
Not me.
Now, when schoolgirl Heather Doyle from Norfolk entered a cartoon competition, she probably didn't expect to see the end result on television.
But that is exactly what's happened. Heather from Long Stratton has just seen her creation aired on the CITV channel.
Now, if we're all sitting comfortably, Jim Rice can tell us more.
This is the story of a little girl who made a cartoon and ended up on television.
Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, no comparison, my friends. This is Tim Banal with another edition of BOA Audio Season 8, this time once again coming at you live. And I'm thrilled to be welcoming back our good buddy, Peter Robbins. I've been itching to get you on the live show for a while now, but I kind of timed it here with the big event coming up in Leominster, Peter. But I've been really itching to talk to you and had to hold my tongue here the 5 minutes before we got started on the live show because there's so much I want to talk to you about. So welcome back to the program, Peter Robbins. Of course, he is the author of Left at Eastgate with Larry Warren. He's an acclaimed UFO researcher, author, lecturer. He really is in the trenches of UFO studies. And it really, if somebody asked me who I wanted as a representative of the UFO field, he'd be at the top of the list. He's just a five-star ambassador for UFO studies, so I can't wait to talk to him. Peter, welcome back to BOA Audio.
Oh, thank you, Tim. It's great to be back on the show with you.
Now, what's been going on since the last time we heard from you? I know you're really fresh off the plane, pretty much. You just were over in Rome doing a big speaker presentation there, but what else has been going on since we heard from you?
Well, last month I took part in what I think is a really unique and important conference, Experiencers Speak, in Portland, Maine, which kind of violated all of the basic format for conventional UFO conferences, namely having people like me and different colleagues as your speakers, and occasionally including a well-known abductee like Travis Walton or something. This conference and the more modestly put together one that we had last year in Maine was just the opposite format. This year, myself and Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin, who of course will be joining me later this month in Leominster, were the UFO speakers, and every other presenter, and there were more than a dozen of them, were experiencers and abductees, and it was a remarkable weekend.
Yeah, that's pretty different. You really don't see too many conferences sort of dedicated to that theme nowadays.
No. There have been a number, especially on the West Coast, more toward the New Age leaning of, you know, positive experiencer kind of conferences, and again, mixed in with more New Age thinking. This one, I thought, is a format whose time has really come, and I hope it becomes an annual conference and that we see more like it. Among the best-known people who were speaking was Travis, who returned along with a buddy of his who will also, I understand, be joining us in Leominster. Steve did an amazing job of kind of being Travis's foil and talking about the impact that being in that truck that fateful day in 1975 and seeing his friend, you know, get out of the truck to kind of goof around under this disc, this large glowing disc, and then have second thoughts about it, but before he could get back to the truck, be Knock to Kingdom Come, and you could sense so deeply in the presentation how the trauma, to a degree, had followed him through all these years. Also, Debbie Jordan Cavill, one of my very favorite people in ufology, who was the subject of Bud Hopkins' best-selling book, Intruders, gave a rare public appearance and right from the heart. Two other true favorites of mine and true heroes of mine, Jim Weiner and Charlie Fultz of the Allagash incident, two of four guys who were abducted from a canoe on a trip in northern Maine, gave a brilliant presentation. And then lots of ones who were maybe known to their friends or a small circle of people or who have come out to some degree also gave very compelling talks. I guess the main thing I was involved in before that was the April and May citizens' hearings on disclosure.
Yes, I saw you.
Brilliantly organized by Steve Bassett at the National Press Club in Washington, which was maybe as close as we're going to get to having a congressional investigation. Steve had invited and offered to pay very well a number of serving congressional representatives or senators. Nobody had the courage to do it. And I don't expect we'll ever see these weasels have that courage within, you know, our lifetime.
They're too busy tanking the country. They don't have...
yeah, they're very busy right now, screwing us all over. What he did, I guess, was the second best thing. He hired six former congressional representatives and a retired senator, and from 9 to 5 or 6 for 5 days in a row, they vetted groups of us. We swore to tell the truth and were questioned in great detail about our areas of specialty. It was a remarkable event, and again, brilliantly well handled and organized.
Nice, nice. Yeah, to jump back to that experience or speak. Yeah, it's amazing. There's quite an interesting sort of grassroots movement going on behind Audrey's work there with the Experiences Project.
Yeah, I agree with you. And behind so many conferences, not like the Big MUFON Symposium or the terrific International UFO Congress, which is now under the guidance and leadership of the Open Minds Organization, so many events have one or two or maybe three people who are just working their butts off and laying out their own money because it's something that they believe in, that they know is important, and that they're willing to take a hit on if it's not a financial success, which is much more the case than not.
Right. I've been a part of some of these, the real passion projects for the people that put them out.
That's right. And for me, it's something that whenever we can, we should lend our assistance and support to. I keep remembering, no matter how well known the individuals in the work or how little known, we are all in this together, and there's really no room for prima donnas as far as I'm concerned. Do your best work, do it whenever you can, and fight for the truth wherever possible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've told the story on the show a bunch of times how I went to that first X conference, and there were a few prima donnas in attendance. Quite a few, and one guy who wasn't was Peter Robbins at the hotel bar, and sort of convinced me that this field was worth at least keeping an eye on still. Because
it was great fun to meet you, and I think sometimes some of the best things that occur at these conferences do happen at the hotel bars after the fact.
Absolutely, yeah, that's where you meet either some interesting characters or some lifelong friends or both.
Yes, exactly.
So I guess tell me a little bit about what was going on here in Rome, because I'm interested, because you do quite a bit of traveling internationally for this kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, what was going on there in Rome, and sort of how did that come about?
Well, this was a really special conference, and it was not a UFO conference. It was a scientific conference devoted to the work and discoveries of Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who's findings on how energy functions are probably more misunderstood and more distorted and more derided than any major scientific figure of the last several hundred years. Ask most people, and if they've heard of Dr. Reich, they've never read anything actually by him, but just about him. And if they've read anything about him, it's often extremely inaccurate and distorted. I was introduced to his work when I was still a teenager, and it had a tremendous impact on my life. Reich, very, very briefly, was Sigmund Freud's first assistant through a good part of the 1920s, and they parted ways in 1929 based on Freud's theory that many, if not most, human neuroses are rooted in sexual problems or an inability. And what Reich had observed after 6 years of working in the Freudian method was no matter how they might appear to be a social or work-related problem or the like, they really had a sexual basis to them, which was a bit much for Freud, but I think actually very accurate. He went on to pioneer extraordinary studies across the board in the natural sciences because the thread that connected all of his work was how energy functions in the natural world. And so this conference, being devoted to Reich's work, cut across everything from cancer formation to childbirth to biology to meteorology to social-political thinking to UFOs, specifically because in the early 1950s, Reich developed an extraordinarily simple but a very effective device which could literally move the atmosphere and properly employed had the potential to break droughts and shrink deserts, an amazing claim, but one that's been borne out repeatedly over the decades. And the thing that really torpedoed part of his scientific reputation toward the end of his life was the simple fact that when he employed this device in Maine and then in extensive field tests in 1955 in Arizona, when he'd use it, it attracted UFO activity.
Oh, weird.
Repeatedly.
Huh.
And at a certain point, in fact, in October, I think, of 1954, he actually turned this machine on a UFO. And it started to wobble. It blinked. It got dimmer and ultimately disappeared.
Wow.
This happened repeatedly. But, of course, it sounds so loopy. It sounds so insane. And so self-aggrandizing, that most scientifically minded people and certainly the general public wrote it off as delusional, except for the simple fact that it was repeatedly, multiply witnessed, that the device itself did and continues to break droughts around the world. And one of our most interesting speakers was Dr. Jim DeMeo. Jim runs a research laboratory not far from beautiful Ashland, Oregon, and he has a degree from the University of Kansas in this technology. How is that possible? And certainly the only degree of its kind in the world. It's that as an undergrad, he put this forward as his objective, and when asked by the university how they could establish that, in fact, it had been effective, his simple response was that he was going to change the weather patterns in that part of Kansas decidedly for the better and to such a degree that they would not be able to deny that it had been responsible for this.
Yeah.
Well, over the years, I am occasionally invited to conferences on Reich's work. The last one was 2 years ago in Greece, some years before that in Oregon, New York City, Nice, France, and I'm pretty much become the main writer, researcher, chronicler of these events. So I gave 3 papers, Friday and Saturday and Sunday of the conference. I think before I spoke, to the chagrin of a few of my colleagues in the audience who felt about my being part of the program the way that a lot of the scientists who were most devoted to Reich's work when he died in 1957 felt about his UFO work.
Right.
Namely,
yeah.
It was not inaccurate. It was not unscientific. It was not unimportant. it just had its own major ridicule factor, and Reich's work already was being ridiculed, and their feeling was it was bad for his acceptance and the science's acceptance in the future. And I absolutely understand that dynamic, all the more reason that I worked very hard to produce three papers that I felt would fill the bill, and audience response was really good. It was wonderful to see colleagues I hadn't seen in a long time, make some new friends, and get to see a little bit of the absolutely amazing city of Rome. What a perk that is.
Yeah, that's an extra bonus for sure. Now, I want to circle back to these. So his technology, this device, it would attract UFOs. And I presume that the technology is still around in some form or fashion today. Has anyone
sort of
reapplied it in modern times to try to get that same effect?
If you were to see one of the devices, it looks something like a multi-barreled anti-aircraft gun, except that it does not shoot anything. And the principle that it operates on is so deceptively simple that a lot of people who might attempt to replicate it as an experiment never bothered, because they just know, in quotes, that it can't work. It doesn't have a motor on it. It doesn't plug into anything. It's not filled with chemicals. It doesn't have a nuclear, you know, apparatus or what have you. Best example I can give you is several years ago when I was in the Boy Scouts. one of the things that we learned was if you get a bee sting, pack mud on it because, you know, that cold, wet earth will make the sting feel better. In reality, that mud is full of energy, and it literally is drawing the toxin to the surface, speeding up the healing process. And it doesn't seem like it could be that way, but that is the way it is. Same thing that I learned at an earlier age, although I didn't understand the dynamics behind it, and I doubt my little Russian grandmother did either. If one of us kids had, you know, a pimple or a boil or something, she'd cut a potato in half, and we'd hold that potato to it, and it would have the same effect.
Really?
In the same way, when Reich first experimented with this device in rural Maine, he aimed the pipes. Oh, the thing is that the pipes themselves are connected to empty industrial BX cable, like, you know, the big versions of the stuff that snakes its way through the walls of our houses with wire in it. The industrial BX is a wider diameter, and you pull the wires out, and you throw the end of the cables into a well or into moving water or into a pond, which acted as a grounding and as an attractor. And what he did, very simply, was start to move moisture-rich atmosphere air from the Atlantic Ocean over Rangeley, Maine, where it displaced the kind of dead, stale air that was moisture-deprived. And after a fashion, it rained. And when they did field tests in 55 in Arizona, they specifically chose an area outside of Tucson because it was about as dry as any part of America had ever been. It had rained 5 inches in 5 years, and over the past 50 years, very modestly. And yes, UFOs were attracted to the area. They were observed not just by the scientific team working with Dr. Reich, but also by a lot of local townspeople, et cetera. And they broke every weather record in the history of Arizona by the end of that operation.
Oh, boy. Well, we need somebody in ufology to put one of these things together and get out in the field and see if it'll work or something,
well,
you know? Because the problem with UFOs is the repeatability thing. So if we have something that may actually attract them, that would be, you know, the Rosetta Stone almost.
Yeah. What Reich deduced was that there was something about the energetics of this very simple device, obviously, that attracted him to the area, but that their motor source may well also be based on harnessing the ocean of energy that we all live in all the time and are completely oblivious to. I don't know anybody who theorizes that truly anomalous UFOs run on gasoline, coal, diesel, wood,
right.
Nuclear. The motor source, of course, is of tremendous interest to world governments, and logic would suggest that it is unconventional, to be sure.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting stuff. It is.
Yeah,
he sounds like a lot like, well, obviously, he sounds a lot like Tesla, but I mean in the way that he's practically been sort of erased from mainstream knowledge. You'd be surprised how few people, the Tesla car and the Tesla band are more well-known than Tesla, so.
It's true. There are some parallels between their lives, but their discoveries differed significantly. I studied Tesla extensively, like a lot of us students of the repressed, the unusual, the unknown, and he was kind of a different sort of genius. One of the things that always fascinated me about Nikola Tesla was his ability to visualize a device, and his were very complex and electrical, and not just visualize it, but visualize an exploded kind of schematic of all of the parts, even if there were many, many parts, to within a tolerance of a hundredth of an inch or something. And many of them, of course, he patented and as such had to, draw out. Other ones he simply kept in his head. And those devices or the possibility of replicating them pretty much disappeared when he died in 1943 in New York.
Yeah, it's amazing. That whole Tesla thing is tremendous. You really wonder.
It is. And it's also an incredible object lesson to all of us. There was a point where George Westinghouse, building his little company called General Electric, was using so many of Tesla's patents that he basically threw himself on Tesla's mercy. Like Reich, he was something of an idealist, certainly a bit naive as to the way the workings of the world could come down on you and eat you alive. And what he offered Tesla, and Tesla accepted, was he said basically, if I had to pay you the royalties on your patents, my company, which is going to do so much good for humanity, will go out of business. Would you accept a one-time payment of $1 million? And Tesla said yes. Had he been harder-nosed or more informed or more sophisticated or more guarded about George Westinghouse's greed and desire to create devices that could be metered and charge everybody in the world money rather than create a free energy grid sort of system where we would all draw energy from the great ocean of energy around us. One wonders how different the world might be today had Tesla had a great crew of advisors and technicians around him and that they took his devices and discoveries in a very different direction. Same for Reich.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the maverick scientists that really, I guess they just kind of go on their own, you know, and they don't have. It's probably, I can imagine it's probably difficult to be the second in command or helper or best friend of the maverick scientists because it's maybe not as easy to deal with on a day to day basis. Now, as I mentioned to you before we started the show, I'm sure we did this when we first talked way back in season one, and you know, obviously, well, I hope I've improved since then, so 8 years later. But I want to revisit the Peter Robbins origin story. How did an artist in New York City get mixed up with the UFO phenomenon? And it's been, 30 plus years now. So how did it all happen? How did this connection become?
Very quickly. By the time I was in my late 20s, I was really living the dream I'd had since I had been a kid. I was quite gifted as a very young artist. By the time I was 8 years old, I was studying oil painting privately. I was the big fish in my little pond in art class growing up in New York and on Long Island. And went to university for a few years, studied art, then went on to the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan, where I graduated with a degree in painting and film history. 2 years later, I started teaching there. And again, by my late 20s, I was selling work here and there. I had a cool loft down in East Chinatown. I was, again, living my dream. And one afternoon, I was at home in my loft. I was going through a number of drawings that I had, much to my surprise, received from my grandmother. They were drawings that I had done when I was a kid that she just put away and, to a degree, I guess, forgot about, then came upon and gave to me. And there are several factors as to why this memory returned to me at that time. I think that was one of them. Some of these drawings did cover the time from this repressed memory. Also, it was right after the Chinese New Year, and in the old days before Mayor Giuliani outlawed fireworks for Chinese New Year. And, you know, the police just always used to look the other way. It is a thousands of year old tradition, and little poppers are just not the same thing. But it was like living in the DMZ for 3 or 4 days. You know, you didn't sleep. You'd walk out on the street and immediately smell cordite instead of Chinese food and be kicking ankle deep through shredded paper. And a memory returned to me from childhood, and it was overpowering. It was a memory of playing on the front lawn of the house that I grew up in on Long Island with my sister Helen. On an absolutely cloudless late morning, I think in June, I was 14 and Helen was 12, and I caught some movement out of my right peripheral vision, called her attention to it, and we watched as five silvery white disc-shaped objects, not highly reflective, definitely metallic, more like brushed aluminum than stainless steel, in a very precise military formation, close enough to make out regular detailing along the edge of which of each, which we could only see or understand as windows or portholes or what have you. And it was a shattering experience for me. We didn't say a word to each other. We looked and we looked and we looked. And I must say, in the intervening decades, I probably interviewed several hundred people over the years who have described the same reaction that I remember having back then. I call it the checklist reaction, and it goes something like this. You look up and you see something completely anomalous in the sky, and your rational mind just starts to go down a list of, that's not a plane, a kite, a blimp, a balloon, a helicopter, a dirigible, a strange-shaped cloud, a reflection from the ground,
yeah,
you know, debris in the sky, and at a certain point you just hit the wall.
Right.
And I was a very straight little kid. At 14, I was not at all sophisticated. I was very leave-it-to-beaverish. I was not into sports, with all due respect. I cooked. I collected rocks and coins and stamps and bugs and any weird thing I could find.
yeah.
I read a lot of books. It may shock you to learn that I was a very short child at that time. And, you know, basically just this nerdiest nerd in Nerdville.
Yeah.
And I knew about flying saucers. You know, they were in the movies, the B-movies that were fun to watch. But I guess I deduced and accepted the adult attitude without anybody ever saying to me, flying saucers are silly. They're science fiction. They don't exist in reality. And there they were. I mean, no appendages. Each one was like a dinner plate, slightly tipped. And it really was mind-blowing. So much so that I was clear that if I talked to any of my buddies about this, they would laugh at me.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be with the cool kids, you know, and I knew this was going to cancel my ticket completely.
So it wasn't like you – so your memory wasn't erased of the thing. It was just later when you looked at the pictures, you kind of felt maybe unburdened to
well,
relook at it?
I guess the dynamic was exacerbated by that afternoon. I rode my bicycle to the public library. I took out two books on UFOs, got them home, brought them up to my room, closed the door, and I just grabbed them off the shelf. In fact, I can say without hesitation, they're the only two UFO books I've ever taken out of a library. I, like a lot of us, I have a pretty good library of them myself at this point. And I was looking for something from the adult world, like a book, that would tell me that they were just totally explainable in conventional terms. And the books did not. In fact, one of them was Adamski's Flying Saucers Have Landed. And I just didn't want to know about that stuff. And I was so committed to not having to wrestle with this that within a matter of weeks, I had basically pushed them out of my mind.
Wow.
Amazing. Yeah, when the memory returned, it was with a vengeance. And I don't even know if I had ever heard the term repressed memory syndrome or if it was a term that was being used in the later 70s, but all I know was that it upset me so much, I just kind of broke. I mean, my first thought was, I know this is real. I mean, it's like this film strip playing in my mind now over and over and over again. How can anybody repress a memory like that? And after calming down, I decided there was only one thing I could do, which was call my sister Helen. And find out if she shared that memory. I gave myself enough time to think over how best to do it, though, to know that what I didn't want to do, Tim, was to tell her what I remembered and hear her say yes or no.
Yeah.
And so she lived a mile or so north of me. I was, again, down in Manhattan's Chinatown. She was an aspiring poet in the East Village. And I asked her if it was a good time to talk and told her I had a remembered something from childhood that I thought was very important and wanted to know if she remembered the same thing, and then set the scene, what the weather was like, where exactly we were standing on the front lawn, about how far from each other, and she just started to laugh and said, stop, I know what you're talking about. This is 14 and a half years later.
Mm.
And she nailed it, and I had this very split feeling of, oh, my God, they're real. And then she said something to me I don't think I'll ever forget, which was, but there's more and you're not going to like it.
Oh.
And I said, well, what was that? She said, well, you know, we were standing there together, and at a certain point I saw you kind of peel off to my right, but I didn't even turn around. I just knew you were running into the house to tell Mom, which was absolutely correct. At that time, I guess lunchtime was coming up, and we were scheduled to eat it. And she said, but within 2 or 3 seconds, the strangest thing happened, which was I watched a beam of blue light shoot out of one of these things. And my first thought was, that's strange, because you can't see a beam of light in the daylight. And yet there it was, you know, like a cartoon or something.
Yeah.
And I turned around, and I saw you in it.
Oh,
then
boy.
The light went out. Then you fell down. And the next thing I remember was I was being lifted off the ground, and the bottoms of these things were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, I'm listening to my sister tell me this, and my first reaction is, oh, my God, my sister's gone insane. And then my second reaction was, wait a minute. 3 seconds ago, it was okay to have 5 flying saucers hanging over the Parker's house, but now your sister's crazy. I was rather unnerved by what she'd observed, although ironically, well, not ironically, in one of the 3 regressive hypnoses I did over the following years to see if maybe I was abducted or if any other memories rattled loose, one of the very few memories that came up in hypnosis that I didn't go in with a conscious recollection was everything going blue for a split second before everything went black. I was knocked out.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and that was something that I had to start living with, and I wasn't doing so well at first. Number one, she then described to me what we would now call incredibly archetypical memories of abduction, being on a metal table, being surrounded by, in her child's mind's eye, little doctors with big heads and big black eyes that spoke to her in her head. And the things that they were saying were textbook examples of more cases that I've worked on than I can imagine. However, I had never heard of this phenomena. Again, in the 70s, we knew something about the Betty and Barney Hill case, but UFOs were never an interest of mine, not even remotely. And so that stuff all bypassed me. And, you know, people say their life changed overnight. Mine changed in about 90 seconds. And the first thing I had to deal with was, what in the name of God happened to my sister? And what is this all about? And for that matter, what happened to me? I resented more than I can say that for the first time in my adult life and most of my child's life, something more important than my career goal of being a painter or some kind of visual artist had displaced it. I really resented it. I continued to paint. I continued to teach. I continued to show my work. But the heart had really gone out of it. And after a number of years, I just acknowledged the fact and turned more and more of my full attention to studying this phenomena, ultimately starting to write about it, submitting some of my writing, getting articles published, and here I am all these years later. And I don't think I would be here for the good work that I've done without my dear sister's support and encouragement. And I know one of the reasons that I continue doing it, aside from the fact that I think I do make some important or good contributions to the work, and that it's important work, is it's a way of honoring my sister's memory. Helen died in January of 2000, and she was always ferociously outspoken about how serious this was, and felt very much that it was part of her responsibility as a human being to help educate other people to the seriousness and reality of this, as well as the importance and significance of it.
That's tremendous. The vividity of the experience that you and your sister had. I have to wonder if the lack of memory, even though you went out and looked into UFOs at the time after it happened, but you know,
that was just literally that afternoon.
Yeah.
And as we continued to talk that afternoon, all those years later, Tim, I said, number one, how could this have happened? How could we have gone all these years without talking about it once? And Helen and I were extremely close. I've never met a closer brother and sister. Part of the reason was we were both artists. We had many of the same friends. We were both cheerful, pot-smoking insomniacs. you know, we were both writers. We edited each other's work. And ultimately, she said, well, that afternoon, I asked you if you wanted to talk about it. And you looked at me and you said, no. And you're my brother. I love you. I respect you. And one day led to the next month, led to the next year, and here we are. I also asked her if there was anything else that she could remember that would kind of underscore the reality of this for me. And she thought about it, and she said, yes. That night after dinner, she had gone into my room, and she saw these two books on my desk, flipped through them briefly, and then went out. And that was incredibly important to me because I returned those books to the Rockville Center Public Library the very next day. And that is something I remember extremely clearly.
What do you think that why is that so significant to you that she checked out the books in
well,
that brief
what was significant to me, and it's something that was a very important lesson for me in what I was going to become, namely an investigative writer.
Mm-hmm.
The small details, the relatively mundane things that are kind of the connective tissue of, you know, large, amazing paranormal things, can be incredibly valuable. The fact that she recalled on this one night only of seeing these two books, and that was the only time she could have seen them,
right, okay.
Just underscored for me how real that day had been, and the fact that yet one more very minor memory of hers dovetailed with an action of mine.
Right, I see.
You know, those things, you get enough of them together, and that's what you build cases on.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, as we kind of established here, you've been in this for a long time, and for the people I really respect as guests, I always try to get their advice for the next generation. So, you know, what would your advice be to people who are just getting into this now, who are taking up an interest in the subject and aren't sure, you know, where to turn or how to even proceed, especially in this new era of ufology with the internet and everything else? I guess, you know, what would your advice be to those folks?
Yeah, well, great question, Tim. Well, if you're getting into it for the money and the women, think twice about that.
Exactly,
First, whether it's UFOs or some other extraordinary subject that you're really passionate about learning more about, make sure that it is a subject that you find incredibly compelling. And for as long as you do, to whatever degree you can, you know, follow that path. But if you lose interest in it, certainly move on to another area. Within UFO studies, there are so many subdivisions. For example, there is the world of trace cases, physiological changes to organic and inorganic material that has come in contact with the UFO or crop circle or other anomalous phenomena. There are witness-related cases, abduction, the actual historical government documents, and by dint of personality or, you know, just quirkiness, one or two of these areas may interest you more than other areas. I know people who have dedicated their lives in great part to Freedom of Information Act actions.
Yeah.
Larry Bryant, a great senior researcher based in Washington, has been doing it for decades. I'm sure Larry has put together hundreds of FOIAs over the years, and that is where his passion drives him. In the internet age, you're faced with a double-edged sword. It still completely blows my mind that, you know, I can go to a search engine and type in the most obscure, arcane reference I can think of, and bang, 2 seconds later, all this information comes piling in at me on this very unusual, rarefied topic.
Yeah.
So much of the internet, though, is good luck with that. It's not like a properly published book by somebody who worked for years establishing their credentials, either by dint of personal research or academic accomplishments, especially with visual materials. We now live in an age where absolutely anything can be created on, well, what we used to call film, but digitally or a manipulated image that is so authentic-looking, either as a film clip or as a still, that, you know, you either have to believe it or not believe it.
Hmm.
For me, I had kind of a personal epiphany. God, how long ago is it that Jurassic Park came out? 15, 20 years, maybe more?
Something like that, yeah, 15 or 20 years, absolutely,
Somewhere in there. I was lucky enough to see it originally in the Ziegfeld Theater in New York, which has the widest screen and the best sound system, the best projector. And there is a moment in that film, and just about everybody listening, I'm sure, has seen it, where Laura Dern and Sam Neill are attending to, they're on their way to attend to some dinosaur, I think, and the John Williams score comes up, and they look up, and there are the brontosauruses grazing. And I sat in the theater at that moment, and I swear to God, for a split second, less than a second, I actually found myself thinking sincerely, holy moly. And I didn't think moly. I thought, Jesus Christ, the secret of this film is not that digital technology is at a point where they can create imagery like this. They found the island where the dinosaurs live. And And then I caught myself and returned to being an adult and thought somewhat wistfully, you know, I can never, ever trust another filmatic image I see again, because we can do anything now. And people often contact me and say, what do you think about, you know, that video clip from Turkey or Jerusalem or Russia? And more, as often as not, I have to say, I don't know what to think of it. It looks good in that, you know, it's not, it doesn't look too good to be true, but yet we don't have, you know, a fully vetted statement from the person that shot it or the person that's with them or an analysis of the film that we're looking at. It's just one of a gazillion, you know, YouTube postings right now or something, you know, on a link that's going viral on the internet. It's one of the reasons why I find pre-digital UFO photographs and footage more compelling in a way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's much more difficult to have faked that stuff, and the fakes, man, they usually stand out like sore thumbs. And you know what? If they don't stand out, you can take, like, a 10-power loop or magnifying glass, and you can often see the cut paper edge of where something was glued down. You know, the technology is not that hard to crack.
Right, it's like a double-edged sword of modern technology. You can
alter all the bad. I would also say, for anybody serious about coming up in this work, don't do what I've done for years, which is, well, unless you are a person of truly independent means or have had a business career that has been successful enough that you can devote yourself to these undertakings without worrying about how you're going to earn a living. This is what I do for a living, and it's not a great way to make money, but it is extremely rewarding work. And again, as we were discussing earlier, some of the perks in terms of places that you're able to visit, either in investigations or conferences, and more, some of the amazing people I've gotten to meet over the years, people who have enriched my life more than I can say, become dear friends. In the world of investigators, experiencers, abductees, people you just meet along the way, you know, nobody told me I should do this. This is totally my own decision. Build a library. I mean a real library of whatever your research specialty is going to be. The written word is an amazing thing. Again, so many people are in an age where, you know, they've got their e-reader, and they're wonderful things. They communicate digitally with everyone. They live in a different world than the one that I was brought into. At the same time, this stuff is very valuable to me as well, but there is no substitute for a real library that you can draw on for research, that you can check facts or at least compare facts from established published sources and not just somebody who posted something on the internet. I would say if you're interested in writing about it and you're not a writer, do what I did and simply start to write. I didn't tell anybody I was writing for a year. I just started to write. And in my case, I began with just childhood memories, trying to describe things to myself in an effective way. Not really worrying about what your style is going to be. Your style is, you know, the way you communicate.
Right, that just comes up naturally as you write more.
And never, ever let, you know, fear of rejection stand in your way. Otherwise, nothing would ever get done. The worst anybody is going to say if you submit an article and doesn't get published is no. And most of us can deal with that very well. Always tell the truth. Hold yourself to a very real code of personal ethics. And if you screw up, either if you fudge it at some point, or you don't hold yourself to that code at some point, or you make a simple error, and in the process of doing that, you publish something that's inaccurate, don't tough it out like a lot of my colleagues do. Go out of your way to let people know that you made that error. And whatever is appropriate, either by correcting it or apologizing to somebody that you may have wronged in the process, is always the right thing to do. Never feel awkward about trying to make contact with people who you admire. And I think back, you know, 25, 30 years, some of my heroes were people like Stanton Friedman and Timothy Good and Len Stringfield and Dr. Hynek. And I met all of them. And in some cases, they became friends. As far as Bud Hopkins goes, I was particularly fortunate. Bud and I met in 1977, which was 76 or 77, about 5 years before he published his first book. What drew us together was his interest in UFOs went back about a year before mine. And what really united us, though, was our love of painting, art history, New York, literature, politics. We were friends for 35 years, and I worked for him as his assistant more than half that time. And that was one of the great privileges and adventures of my life. But never feel awkward about trying to make contact with people that you admire in public life. Once again, worst that's going to happen is you won't hear from them, or, you know, they may be a jackass, but much more often than not, they may remember somebody being there for them when they were just starting out and be happy to, communicate and be there for you and bounce ideas off of and be a mentor.
All fantastic advice. I recognize some of these steps in my own evolution as a researcher and broadcaster. So,
yeah,
you know, don't be afraid to, people always ask me, what, you know, how'd you get Stan Friedman on the show? It's like, I just called him.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, don't be afraid to get out there. And the only other thing would be maybe develop a thick skin, because this is a subject that, you know, not only contains its own slings and arrows of infighting, but also you got to deal with people on the outside who don't understand your interest in this subject.
Well, you're absolutely right, Tim. And you can do that without becoming insensitive. If you are attacked, often the attacks aren't even worth responding to. I call them ankle biters. They're just, you know, mean-spirited people or frightened people more often than not who have a need to attack what you have said or written because it makes them extremely anxious. And if that is ineffective, to attack you personally. A lot of people in this work like me very much, but you would be surprised how nasty some of the attacks on me have been, and very recently, and by people in the work. And, you know, you just deal with it. When you do address it, though, never generalize. Always be really specific. And if they have said X, Y, and Z, you know, even though you may have to take X number of hours that you would rather devote to something else, if it's important enough to you, do not hesitate to come back at them. But always, while fighting hard, fight fair. Never let yourself be pulled down to the level of, you know, second graders going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. And, you know, upping the silliness and just the nasty expletives. Be specific. Do your best to stay above the fray, but never flee or feel that you shouldn't come back at somebody if they are, you know, saying something untrue about you or distorting your work or, you know, just general jackasses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sometimes you just can't help but avoid but run into those people. Really need to try and avoid them, I guess. Now, I wanted to talk to you about the citizens' hearing on disclosure, because, as I said, I saw you as a part of that whole thing, and wasn't the last time we talked, but it was the one prior to that. You had just put out the paper that you wrote about religious concerns surrounding disclosure.
Yeah, it was actually a paper, I think the original draft was called Politics, Religion, and Human Nature, and then the subtitle was To the Effect of Roadblocks in the Way of Public revealing of information around this subject, i.e. disclosure.
I think, yeah, you said you purposely didn't use the word.
Yeah, it was sort of an experiment. The word disclosure, I certainly am not as dogmatic about right now. It's a perfectly good word, and there really are no synonyms for it. So it's, you know, you always have to come up with different phrases. But I felt that it was heavily associated with, you know, one area of the movement that I was not very fond of. It was sort of a personal exercise coming out of my readings and chats with people who exercised a fair amount of concern and resistance, and in some cases, absolute dogmatism, that they wouldn't even be interested in looking at this as a reality, because if it were true, it would challenge too many of their beliefs as far as religion goes. And if a crack developed in the wall, and for me a perfect example is a very famous part of the New Testament, Ezekiel. You know, Ezekiel is a simple shepherd. He's minding his flock. And lo, out of the heavens comes a wheel within a wheel of the appearance of burnished beryllium. And it's nothing gossamer-like or angelic. It comes down. It kicks up all kinds of sand. And out of it comes an angel. Now, the word angel, the first usage we have of the word is in ancient Sumerian, and it doesn't have anything to do with religion. It's a word that would be just as useful in the halls of power. It's a go-between, an emissary.
Yeah.
This particular angel is also encased in metal, and its head has four kind of animal depictions on each side of it, like a very, very intense helmet of some sort. And there, you know, a rapport and exchange is struck up, and there is a relationship that is established between Ezekiel and this being. Now, let's just say, for argument's sake, that the entire Bible was, you know, true stories written by God with his giant fountain pen, or, you know, written by contemporaries of that time as honestly and as best as they could. I personally feel the Bible is a mixture of many things, including recycling of earlier myths, morality tales, analogies, allegories, etc. But let's just say that the description we find in Ezekiel is a misinterpretation of a genuine visitation of a craft of certainly advanced dynamics, piloted by intelligences from parts unknown, coming and going with impunity, for reasons we can only make educated guesses at. If such a thing were true, for some people, it would be incredibly upsetting. It would suggest that other parts or references or stories in Judeo-Christian tradition or other world religions may have been just that, a misinterpretation or misunderstanding, very understandably, of a visitation. And this is something that impacts on people of every religion if they're fundamentalist, and the word simply means inflexible in your interpretation of dogma. Mm. I think most people of faith have a certain latitude about them, and I think after a lot of study and a lot of interviews, I'm convinced that, you know, if disclosure were to come, and if it does, I don't think it's going to be something that comes from the United States government. I think, if anything, they're going to do everything they can to do what they've always done, which is not a damn thing,
right,
to get any closer to this, unlike many other governments who have been a lot more forthcoming. I think that most people of faith are going to, you know, have a dark night, but think about it. I mean, if they're... is this life coming and going from another planet, another universe, another dimension, another star system, another galaxy, or all of the above, which I think is probably as likely, doesn't that underscore the vastness of creation in the universe? If anything, it should serve as a confirmation of, if you are a person of faith, of, you know, God's presence at the furthest corners of the cosmos, or if you're a secularist, that the miracle of creation in terms of the way many of us see evolution is also potentially out there. And I don't know, it was only the past few years that stats were published that among even very conservative astronomers, it is admitted that there are some millions of planet-sized objects about the same distance we are from our sun to similar-sized stars, at least giving voice to the premise that, you know, that primordial chemical biological soup that resulted in the first paramecium and amoeba and simple one-celled creatures, or that first thus spake Zarathustra, God's finger on the water, and life began, depending on your point of view. It's a paper I'm really proud of, and one that was in my mind earlier this year when I was in Washington for this amazing series of hearings.
Red Sox trailing 5-1, and Poppy gets in. And the big right-hander, Benoit, delivers. Swinging a high, deep drive into right field. That one scalded to right. Hunter on the move, racing back. It's over his head. It's gone. It's into the bullpen. This game is tied. This game is tied. David Ortiz.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Torrey Hunter went up against the wall, running pell-mell up against the fence, and then went tumbling into the Red Sox bullpen as David Ortiz has sent Fenway Park into a state of delirium.
You talk about dramatic home runs in his career. Wow.